everyone, and welcome to episode 130 of season 1 of the Mover and Bidet podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and once again, I'm going to be doing a solo episode. So episode 130 begins with Liebgott asking a question and ends with Webster not being able to believe it. So we ended things yesterday with Liebgott and Webster getting into an argument about whether the place where they're on their way to go to, whether this man is a civilian or whether he is a soldier. And Liebgott starts by saying, "You think he's a soldier like you and me? And he's a German officer. Where the hell you have been for the past 3 years?" And Liebgott just leaves him and starts walking into the the farmhouse on its own, and he pulls out his pistol and points it at the man that's in there. This man obviously is dressed like a farmer, and he just starts speaking to him in German, and then Liebgott goes, "What?" And the man shouts back in German. Liebgott goes, "Shut up." Liebgott speaks to him in German, and he goes, "No, come here, old man." And he continues speaking to him in German, and these three guys are not 100% sure what's going on. The man obviously looks very scared, and Webster just can't take any of this. And, he looks around the place. He can't find anything. And then Liebgott and the Germans start getting into an argument, and the man is frantic in trying to explain something. And Liebgott just takes his gun and points it at the guy. And he goes, "Don't lie to me." And then he goes, "See what you did to my people? 9-9. He goes, "All right, that's it." And these guys just start, arguing even more. And like I said, Webster just had enough. Webster has left and leaves the farmhouse. Goes outside to light up a cigarette. And you see that he is clearly shaking. He's not comfortable with what they need to do here. And, he hears dishes breaking a little bit and stuff like that. And then Sisk comes out. Webster's basically just ignoring Sisk. And this guy goes, "He's guilty." And he goes, "Liebgott says so." And he goes, "He probably is." And then we hear a gunshot and then footsteps. And, Webster is not happy about this whole thing. We see the Germans start, running up the hill nearby. And Liebgott comes out and starts chasing after him. And Liebgott's gun jams. He's not able to shoot him. But this German is still running up the hill, trying as hard as he can to get away. And Liebgott just looks at Webster, and he screams, "Goddamn son of a bitch, shoot him, shoot him!" And Webster goes, "Nope." And, we get a shot of the German continuing to run up the hill, trying to get some sort of safety. And then we hear a shot ring out, and we see the guy get shot in the back and falls down. Webster looks over and he sees Sisk, Wayne Sisk. So it's Sisk that is there with them, and he's the one who actually takes the shot for the whole, to take him out. And I don't think we really see Sisk that much beyond this particular scene. He was part of Easy Company all the way from the beginning. And he was actually one of the first four soldiers to be a part of Easy Company all the way back in Tekoa with Percante, Herman Hansen, and Lipton. And he was wounded during the Battle of the Bulge, and then ends up rejoining them. And he was also he was on Winter's Plain on D-Day, and he kept asking the men if they wanted to buy a good watch. So, basically, even according to the Band of Brothers wiki page, that he's pretty much just predominantly in this scene here, even though he does appear in other scenes of the, in the miniseries. We do get to see him, but this is one of the few scenes where we actually get more about him. Because he is in a total of 9 episodes, And he's played by an actor named Philip Barantini, who was also in Ned Kelly and Chernobyl, and he won a BAFTA for his work on Adolescence. He was both the director and one of the producers. So this past year in 2020, the beginning of 2026, he won a BAFTA for his work on that show. He also won two Emmys for that also, both as one of the producers and as the director of the limited series. And he also won a PGA. So he's got a lot that he's done now, which is great. All these years later, he still is doing stuff that impactful along the way. But yeah, I mean, we see on the face of Sist that he's not sure if he was supposed to do that or not, but he knew that it was the right he believes it was the right decision. And then Liebgott says, "Officers don't run." Webster goes, "The war's over. Anybody would run." Again, this is once again another story of things that happened after the men were, I guess, starting to get a little bored, I guess you can sort of say. But so the book, as I teased yesterday, the book does talk about this particular scene. And on page 229, it says, "Other high-ranking German officials, men who had good reason to fear that they would be charged with war crimes, were hiding in the mountains. Spears was told by the DPs about a man who had been the Nazi head of a slave labor camp in the area and had committed a great many atrocities. He investigated, asked questions, and became convinced they were telling the truth. Further investigation revealed that this man was living on a small farm nearby. Spears called First Lieutenant Lynch, explained the situation, then gave his order: take Moon, Liebgott, and Sisk, find him, and eliminate him. Lynch gathered the men, explained the mission, got a weapons carrier, and took off up the mountain. During the trip, Moon thought about his predicament. He was sure that Captain Spears did not have the authority to order an execution based on testimony from the DPs, but Spears was a company CO, and Moon was just an enlisted man carrying out an order. He decided, I'm not complying with this bull. If someone has to do the shooting, it won't be me. They got to the farm and without a struggle took the Nazi prisoner. Liebgott interrogated him for 30 minutes, then declared there could be no doubt. This was the man they wanted, and he was guilty as charged. The Americans pushed the man at gunpoint to the weapons carrier. They drove off. Lynch stopped beside a ravine. They prodded the man out of the vehicle. Liebgott drew his pistol and shot him twice. The prisoner began screaming. He turned and ran up the hill. Lynch ordered Moon to shoot him. You shoot him, Moon replied. The war's over. Skinny Sisk stepped forward, leveled his M1 at the fleeing man, and shot him dead. So, the idea that they switched Webster for Lynch in this place, but it's still somewhat accurate about the fact that Liebgott was the one who was leading the interrogation and actually tried shooting the guy. Ultimately, it was Sisk who put him down for good. So I guess basically just because we don't know Lynch as one of the characters, so they just switched to somebody else. And then the shot changes and we see the three men driving in the Jeep silently, each of them obviously reflecting on what they just did right now. And we hear more narration from Winters, and he says, "Summer in this alpine paradise should have been a welcome relief, especially now that we were at peace with the Germans. Everyone just wanted to go home." And the shot then changes, and we see a sign that says Salzburg, Saalfelden, and Saalbach, 15 kilometers. And we see one of the men of Easy standing at a post, watching people going down the road. A wagon with being led by horses starts coming towards him. So I was thinking about the fact that we talked about here we have Salzburg, and we have Saalbach and all those things. So first of all, Salzburg is the birthplace of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. It is also the primary filming location for The Sound of Music. Mozart was born there in 1756. There are museums that you can go see Mozart's birthplace at the Gütersgasse shopping street, as well as where he was living later on in his life. Some of the places that they filmed for The Sound of Music is in the Mirabell Palace and Gardens, where they did the Doremi rendition. And you also have the gazebo, which is part of the Hellborn Palace. And then if you want to talk about Saalbach, so Saalbach is a resort located in the Austrian Alps, and it is a premier year-round mountain resort. They have a massive ski circus, ski area, world-class mountain biking, and lively après-ski scene. And Yeah, the terrain, there's about 270 kilometers of slopes that people can go to. It's one of the largest ski areas in Austria itself. They have 70 modern cable cars and lifts that allow seamless transition across mountains without the need of having to take a bus to get from slope to slope. And they have a rich history of people coming there to for professional skiing, and the Alpine World Ski Championships have been have taken place there. And they have bike park and trails, and it has extensive trail networks, and they have what's known as the Big Five Bike Challenge, which one is able to partake in. And it sounds as if it's a very big event. And the idea of the Big Five Bike Challenges is that it's a mountain bike free ride that spans five different mountains and connects the resort of Saalbach, Kilterglemm, and Leogang, all in one day. The total distance on this challenge is 61.1 kilometers, which is 38 miles of riding. The downhill descent is 5,000 vertical meters, 16,400 feet of pure downhill trail riding, but the uphill is 500 vertical meters, 1,640 feet, where you need to do that on your own. And it usually takes about 6 hours for someone to complete it. Obviously it depends on your level and skill. Some of us it'll probably take a little longer. And they also have a thing called the Joker card there, which gives you two free bike lift transport sessions per day, and you get a discount on the one day bike pass by if I can do that. Now, I don't know why it's called the Joker card, because it to me, whenever I hear the Joker, so I think of Batman. But shout out to Niall and John of the Batmimic. Maybe they have a Joker card that they use when they go skiing. I don't know. As the scene here progresses, we see that we see a German, I guess, MP standing on one side of the, and he's having a conversation with Janovic. And he goes, "France. France was the best." "Really?" "Yeah. 5 years, I think I was in every country, but France was the best. Italy would be second for me. Russia is not desirable. Ukraine? It was okay." So Janovic then says to him, "So, when do you get out?" He goes, "My unit is discharged. We leave when my captain gets transferred. It is the end of my second war." "Jesus, I'm going home now to Mannheim." And Janovic then tells him that another car shows up, and he goes, "I'll take this one." And he okay. And then Janovic then walks over to the truck that has now shown up, and checks the papers real quickly, lets them go by, and then salutes the people in the back of the truck as they go by. And then Webster shows up, basically changing places with Janovic. Janovic goes, "Hey, Webster, my relief." And Webster says to him, "Stop saluting the Germans." So Webster did get to see that's what Janovic was doing. And he then hands him a holster with a gun, and we see an injured German soldier coming towards them on crutches, with the you can still see the German MP in the background dealing with a different car that has shown up. Webster then looks at the paper from the soldier. Janovic says, "Well, come on, I get sort of kicked out of it. Anyway, I've got me a new enemy, the Japs." He goes, "75 points. How about you? You're the call man, right? How many you got?" Webster just looks at him and goes, "Wouldn't you like to know?" He looks over at the German soldier and goes, "Discharged, huh? All right, go ahead. Take off." And then he turns to Janovic and goes, It's my turn." Janovic says, "All right, see you at the farm." Also it's you see the ease that these men have, are they're easing into this type of life where they're policing everything that's going on. They're showing up, replacing one another as they should. And as Janovic starts walking towards the Jeep, Webster goes, "81." He goes, "Huh?" He goes, "I have 81 points." Janovic goes, he laughs and goes, "Well, she's not good enough." And then he starts to drive off from the Jeep with or as we talked earlier this week, you need 85 points in order to be released. So he's just 4 points short. And they give us a great shot of the Jeep. It's basically Janovic's perspective of Webster, because the camera moves around the German who's standing in front of Webster, and Webster just looks at him and walks over to a car that the German MP has stopped there, and he goes, let's see if I get you a ride. And he goes, hey, where are they going? And he goes, Munich. And he turns to the German and goes, want to go to Munich? And they start speaking German, and Webster then just opens the back seat and just starts throwing these people's luggage out. And then he turns to this German soldier and goes, get in. And he looks at the driver and he goes, and the driver and his wife, and he goes, too bad. Webster is not pulling any punches here. He's willing to make sure that the Germans, civilians, will suffer a little bit in everything that they were either a part of or the fact that they just ignored throughout the course of the then the shot changes and we see Janovic driving in the Jeep down the road. We see a army truck pass them, and we see a second army truck pass them. And in the second army truck, a barrel seems to fall off of the truck and, you know, gets in the way of the car. We hear the screeching sound. Then we get a shot of Webster's horrified eyes as he hears a horn blaring. Janovic screams, turn the wheel! And then we hear a crash, and Webster looks and goes, oh, Jesus! He gets to see what... you know, what's happened to his friend, and he just starts running off to see what's happening. We see that the Jeep has been overturned and is smoking as the two army trucks just continue. Nobody seems to notice anything different. And then the shot changes, and we have an ambulance, and Winters runs up to the ambulance and sees Janovic just lying there. And then we get the friend of the show, Corey Johnson, who plays Kent, who's the regimental doctor. He looks at him and goes, it's Private Janovic. He was dead when they brought him in. And then we see that Spears and Webster are both standing there. And Winters has a look on his face that, what a waste. This is something that could have been so much better and safer. And it just wasn't. And then Webster turns to Winters and goes, 75 points. So again, we know that Janovic only had 10 points left. He got to go home also. So that was also pretty close, the whole thing. So the book does mention the story with Janovic also. So I'm going to quickly read that. It's on page 235 of the book. And it says here, adding to the problems of frustration and anger caused by the point system was a combination of too much liquor, too many pistols, and too many captured vehicles. Road accidents were almost as dangerous to the 101st in Austria as the German army had been in Belgium. In the first 3 weeks in Austria, there were 70 wrecks, more in the 6 weeks of June and July. 20 men were killed, nearly 100 injured. One night, Sergeant Robert Marsh was driving Private John Janovic back from a roadblock by a side road. Janovic was leaning on the unreliable door of a German truck. He hit a log. He lost his balance, fell, and hit his head on the pavement. Marsh rushed him to the regiment aid station in Zellenzum. He died on the way of a fractured skull. Captain Spears gathered up his few personal possessions, a watch, his wings, his wallet, and his parachute scarf, and mailed them to Janovic's parents. He had come a long way, Webster wrote. He had jumped in Holland and fought in Bastogne. He hated the army. And now, when the war was over and the golden prospect of home was in sight, he had died. Marsh had not been drinking. Easy Company was proud of its record with regard to mounting guard duty or many roadblocks with sober, responsible soldiers, and in not driving drunk. Others were not so careful. Private Keefe recalls the night he was at a roadblock with Private Lloyd Guy, halfway between Salfenden and Zellemzen. An open German staff car came barreling down the road, not prepared to stop. Guy and I jumped out in front of it and made them stop. There were two men dressed in German uniforms, both drunk. The hell are you stopping us for? We're on your side. There were a couple of our paratroopers, but from some other company. We told them, damn it, you could get your heads blown off. They finally promised to slow down on the driving. We told them the next guard post was about 10 miles up the road, to keep an eye out for it and slow down to a crawl. They promised to take it easy. But when we got back, we learned those two damn fools had barreled right through Welling's post with Welling out yelling, halt, halt. After the third halt, Welling took one shot and hit the driver. Later, Welling visited the wounded man in the hospital. He had no hard feelings towards Welling that we've done that he would have done the same thing. So yeah, I mean there's a lot of strange stuff going on here that is not a good thing. But I mean they were even playing practical jokes. So there was a party here on page 232. It describes it. The officers too were having an ongoing party. Spears had snatched a couple of cases of fine brandy, when she enjoyed his living quarters with a beautiful Polish DPA and her small child. Colonel Sink gave some memorable parties at his HQ, the Hotel Zell. One night he invited all 506 officers to meet General Taylor and his staff. It was a bash. Colonel Strayer, who according to Lieutenant Foley could put away quite a bit of liquor, got a little rambunctious. He got into a fistfight with the general. Lieutenant Foley and a couple of the others got a bright idea. They went to the parking lot and siphoned most of the gas from General Taylor's Mercedes. It had belonged to Hitler. They thought it would be very funny when he ran out of gas on his way back to Birch's Garden in the middle of the night. The next morning, Sunday, Colonel Sisk ordered a special officer's call. They assembled outside the hotel. Sink laid into them. He said their behavior was disgraceful. He touched especially on the brawling and on the practical joke. He just got off the phone with General Taylor, whose car had run out of gas, and who had sat there for hours while his driver searched for a jerry can. Foley, who did not confess, reported that Sink didn't give a damn whether enlisted men stopped enlisted. He was angry, and he didn't care who heard him give. And he didn't care who heard him give every one of us hell. Spelled H-E-L-L. Sink never stayed mad long. A week later, he laid on a huge 4th of July celebration, but on the 4th it rained, and again on the 5th. Never mind, the 6th was a beautiful day, and the celebration began. Sink on the 6th, the men called it. On Sunday, we will have something that's even more interesting and quite tragic that we're going to talk about also. That's all I have to say about episode 130. So yesterday, I talked about why I decided to do Band of Brothers as my season 11 of this podcast, but I didn't really talk about my history with Band of Brothers. That's something I've touched upon it over the course of the season, but not so much. So I figure that now is the perfect time to tell you all where that all stems from. So as you all are, I'm sure, completely aware, I'm a big fan of Saving Private Ryan. And after Saving Private Ryan came out, well, actually, you can go back further. I am a big fan of Apollo 13. Apollo 13 is also among one of my top-rated movies that I just love and can watch over and over. Shout out to Jim O'Kane and Chris Henry, who did the Apollo 13 Minute. Thank you both for such a great season that you guys did that I just loved listening to, because it enhanced my thoughts about that movie also. But I digress. So Apollo 13 came out. I loved it. And then HBO did the miniseries From the Earth to the Moon. Basically, Tom Hanks decided that he wants more in-depth information for people to understand about the Apollo missions. So he helped create From the Earth to the Moon. And From the Earth to the Moon is probably among my all-time favorite miniseries of Band of Brothers. I mean, I know that I've had the discussion, I think I even had the discussion with Chris at the beginning of the season as to whether From the Earth to the Moon or Band of Brothers is a better miniseries. And the bottom line is they're both amazing in my opinion. And I have a lot of trouble comparing them, but The feelings that I get from both are very different, but they're both very powerful. So From the Earth to the Moon is a miniseries that I would watch over and over. I've probably seen it at least 10 or 15 times the nearly 30 years since it came out. It came out in 98, which means that, you know, I try and see it at least once every year or two because it's just so amazing. And again, that's 12 episodes to keep rewatching, but why not? It's been 28 years since it came out, but still, it's something that I love watching, and it's because I'm a fan of the U.S. space program and the Apollo missions and everything like that. And From the Earth to the Moon enhanced that love for that era of time for me, because it gave me so much information that I didn't have before. And I've learned so much about that era since that always makes me wonder why they skipped certain things. There are some of the Gemini missions that I'm really shocked they didn't try to put in somehow into that first episode. The near disaster and, you know, the fact of, you know, how long both Jim Lovell and Frank Borman had to spend, you know, in a cramped ship together, and how much they stunk when they eventually got back to Earth. And they both really needed showers and baths after that, which says a lot about, you know, men being able to spend so much time in a capsule in space. But you got to think about hygiene, too, at the same time. So at the same time that From the Earth to the Moon was starting to be shown, so that's when Tom Hanks came out with Saving Private Ryan. Once again, a movie that I had heard a lot about before it came out, and I went and saw it, and I loved it. And that's another movie that I've seen so many times. I recall, and I know I mentioned this during the Saving Private Ryan season, that I actually saw it twice in the theater because a very good friend of mine, Yoni, who doesn't remember the story because I asked him about it last year, that he called me up one day and says, "Have you seen Saving Private Ryan?" And I said, "Yeah, I saw it already." And he's like, "Okay, you know, I'm going to go see it, and I want you to come see it with me again." And I'm like, "Ah, I'll see it, you know, I'll be able to see it whenever I want." And he's like, You will never have this type of experience ever again. You will not be able to go to the theater and watch it the same way that you can now. He said, get up off your ass and let's go watch it. And we did. And I loved it the second time that I watched it also. And the rest is history from that perspective. Then I started hearing rumors about 2 years later that Tom Hanks was doing the same type of thing that he did for Apollo 13 with From the Earth to the Moon. He was going to be doing Band of Brothers, which I had heard of, but I didn't really know very much information about it. I knew it was a World War II D-Day story, but that's all I knew. And I bumped into a friend of mine at the time, name is Sean, and Sean was started telling me about it. He said, "Oh wow, the Band of Brothers is going to be great. It's going to be this, it's going to be that." And he got me even more excited about wanting to watch it. And then it debuted on TV, and Sean and I watched it with another group of friends. We were all part of a singles community. The little town that we were living in, there were a bunch of apartment buildings that had a lot of singles there, and we were all good friends. And we just had group viewings every week of this show when it came out, and it was just an amazing experience watching it that way. And I immediately fell in love with the story, with the characters and everything like that. And that is another miniseries that I try to watch every year, year and a half. I can't give an exact figure of how many times I've seen Band of Brothers, but I've seen it a lot. And now that I've gone and watched it 5 minutes at a time, I've gotten an even deeper understanding of everything that's going on. And I'm now more aware of a lot of things with the various characters. Having spoken to family members and people on the production and stuff like that, that's also given me a much deeper feel for everything that went on with the making of Band of Brothers. And I think that once someone does a movie minute by minute, or in some sort of format that's connected to minute by minute, but where you really break things down on a very deep level, you get a much deeper appreciation for it. There are people who've said to me, said, "Oh, come on, you're doing all these movies. Do you get sick of watching them after you've now talked about them for 6 months in such minute detail?" And the truth is, it's the exact opposite. It's the type of thing that now that I watch them, when I watch any of these the movies that I've done, now the count is at 11. Whenever I've rewatched any of them, I have an enhanced appreciation for everything that goes on because I now notice all the little things that I didn't notice before. And there are things that the director, producer, writer, or whatever, they added into all these movies, and they didn't expect people to really notice them. But doing things minute by minute gives you a completely different perspective on how the story of the movie is being told. And you're not in a rush, so you have the time to take a look and see, okay, well, why did they do this and why did they do that? And oh, did you notice that this particular thing shows up here and then it shows up later? I mean, a perfect example of this is, when I had Nick Rehak on in The Great Escape. So we were dealing with the tenants of the distillery, and we happened to notice that something looked really weird about what they're using on the distillery, and we realized that it was a, I think, trombone that one of the characters had been carrying around earlier in the movie. And it's like, wow, I'd seen The Great Escape so many freaking times over the years. I never thought about the fact that they're going to reuse things. I mean, the truth is, just today I rewatched Apollo 13, so that's why it's heavily on my mind about this aspect. But there's the idea where they have to create the filter and make a square box go into a round peg, that type of thing. And the one thing that they constantly keep saying to the guys is you only have what they have, which basically tells us, I mean, going back to the idea of the Great Escape. So okay, the guys are in a prisoner of war camp, and what can they use to make a distillery? They have to use things that they can find in the camp. And one of the things they apparently found was a musical instrument that you can use to help distill booze along the way. So again, that's one of the reasons why I love doing these type of things. Now, for Band of Brothers, there's an even deeper connection for me about the whole thing, because I had an uncle who unfortunately passed away about 10 years ago. He and I were relatively close, and I always knew that he was in Bestone. He was in the Battle of the Bulge. I don't know what he did. I think he once said to me that he was in a tank smasher or something like that, but I never really got the story from him, which I somewhat regret that I. Many other stories that we've heard from people who spoke to vets over the years, where they just didn't open up about their story. Like, so I never got his story. But the one thing that glaringly is in my mind is after I had the DVD box set that I bought of Band of Brothers. So at one point, I don't remember if I suggested it to him or he asked for it, that he wanted to watch it. I didn't suggest that we watch it together. I let him, watch it on his own. And when he gave it back to me, the only thing he could say to me was, wow, that really brings back a lot of things that I went through. But he wouldn't elaborate, and I didn't want to push it. And again, it's one of those things that maybe I should have pushed it a little bit just to get a little more information, because I'm more familiar with what happened there. Again, not as familiar as the men that were there for obvious reasons, and not people who completely study it, but just from a layman's perspective, I guess. So that is my history with Band of Brothers. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Mini. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movearoundmini.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movearoundmini@movearound.net. So I'll be back on Sunday, but until then, Curhee!